In a nearly century-old airship hangar outside Akron, a seven-member crew is bolting together triangular girders made of aluminum and carbon fiber. They'll make up the internal frame of the new blimp. They'll have three engines that run on aviation fuel. Right behind the workers rests the old GZ-20 model blimp, which has no internal structure and just two engines. Goodyear's Ed Ogden looks over the new version.
I'm asked constantly, will this be called a blimp? Well, the fact is, technically, it is not a blimp. It's an airship. It's a semi-rigid airship. I would never discourage anyone from calling anything that we build out of here coming out calling it a blimp.
The new blimp will carry up to 12 passengers, five more than the current model. The new polyester envelope is filled with both air and helium. It'll also be 50 feet longer, stretching to 246 feet, or about the same length as the largest 747 jumbo jet.
It's going to look long and skinny as compared to kind of the chubby one that we have today.
That's Goodyear's Director of Global Operations for Airships, Nancy Ray. While Zeppelin designed most of the airship, Goodyear designed the cockpit at the front of the gondola.
Our current method for flying is completely mechanical, and this is completely electrical and very high-tech.
Zeppelin has two similar dirigibles flying in Germany, selling rides to tourists. But you can't buy a ticket for the Goodyear blimp. Rides are invitation only. These are working vehicles. They help televise some 120 events a year, all the while spreading the Goodyear name. They carry more than 80,000 LED lights, a number that's about to double, enabling them to run graphics day and night. A couple years ago, the London-based Event Magazine named the Goodyear blimp to its list of the top six guerrilla marketing campaigns. Pretty trendy for the company that's been using blimps for promotion since 1925. The airship is hardly edgy, but one of the pilots, James Cosmos, who used to fly jets, isn't complaining.
The blimps are way more fun. What? 20 miles an hour at 1,000 feet is more fun. You see a lot more, and it's a little bit more of a challenge to fly, too, so it makes it exciting.
Wow. More challenging than a jet?
Yeah, because there's so many more variables, winds and temperatures and, the physics of the helium and things like that that make it more of a challenge.
The new Goodyear blimp is expected to be completed this fall and starts flying soon after. For NPR News, I'm Mark Uricki.
Let's take a look at an American business that has found a lot of success in the last couple of years. Ford has had sales jump in recent years as it has dropped unsuccessful models and adopted a single global manufacturing system. The Ford Focus is now the best-selling car in the world, toppling the Toyota Corolla, which held that title for years. NPR's Sonari Glinton has this report.
One of the ways that the Ford Focus has been able to get to the top of the global heap is by streamlining. Take one car, build it all over the world. Mike Wall is an analyst with IHS Automotive. He says that's let Ford benefit from economies of scale.
Because those economies of scale are critical when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars, as it were, in research and development budgets and capital expenditure budgets. So you've got to get, it's all about getting more bang for your buck.
Ford has eliminated brands and models and focused on a few cars. Note that I said cars. Ford, for many years, has been willing to give up on cars and put its real energy in trucks and SUVs. Now, that's changed, and so has its approach to building cars. Wall says the auto companies used to essentially build cars for each region of the world. He says Ford will still customize his cars for each market.
But you're not going to be building a whole darn car from the ground up in each of these markets, or having to design a whole car from the, soup to nuts as it relates to that in each of these markets. You've got a very strong baseline to work with, and that is the Focus.
Wall says Ford is the first of the American companies to benefit from the one-car strategy. The others aren't too far behind. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine here on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Tiger Woods seems to be at the top of his game. After a lot of struggles with his personal life, Woods is again ranked number one as he gets ready to tee off at the Masters on Thursday. But commentator Frank DeFord says it isn't a wonderful story of a comeback.
Let us now ponder the exquisite status of Tiger Woods, who's clawed his way back to the top of the charts, thereby to proclaim, with the help of his Nike mouthpiece, that his ragged and raw past few years never really happened because, as his ad says, ta-da, winning takes care of everything. And yes, indeed, he is number one in the rankings again. And two, he has a beautiful new girlfriend, although, of course, I will not mention her name here so as not to be a member of what he calls the stalkerazzi. And yet, that is why his position is so much more intriguing than ever. Really, you see, Tiger only stands perched at the juncture of exhilaration and peril. We do so love comebacks. In recent years, it's even become de rigueur in many sports to anoint the comeback player of the year, along with the MVPs and other top dogs. Comebacks are official now. For some reason, we proclaim the nonsense that there are no second acts in American lives, but in contradiction, we live by the studied belief that we are a nation of second chances. Not comeback kids, but comeback grown-ups. In a real sense, though, Tiger has set himself up for greater possible frustration. For in his sport, being number one is really secondary. It's like a team winning the regular season but failing in the playoffs. No, in golf, winning one of the four major Grand Slam tournaments is the accepted measure of greatness. All the more so for Woods, who has not won a Grand Slam in almost 5 years and whose sublime goal was to win the most majors ever. How tantalizing it must be for him at this moment. He comes to the Masters, to a familiar course that suits him, hot and confident, perfect button. But should he not win, how much more painful. To reach the brink and not succeed is in any endeavor far more agonizing than only to march in the middle of the parade. And for Woods, who's been to the mountaintop, it would be even more distressing. Because each time he fails now, the bloggerazzi will whistle, sure, number one, but can't win the big one anymore. The fascinating analogy to Woods would be Andre Agassi in tennis, who, like Tiger, tumbled from the top with an injury as his marriage crumbled. Agassi plummeted all the way to 141, while Woods only slipped to 58. But Agassi would recover, find love with another famous athlete, sound familiar to you, Snooperazzi, and win another Grand Slam after almost 5 long years, nearly precisely the time it would be for Woods should he win the Masters. But in celebrity cases, like Agassi, like Woods, the challenge is more tortuous and transparent. To them, it is not comeback, it is get back.
Frank DeFord is a commentator for NPR. He appears regularly on Morning Edition. He's based out of Connecticut. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio.
A failing school district in El Paso, Texas, reported dramatic improvements. What was behind that apparent success?
We had a superintendent who engaged in criminal activity and worked with others inside the district to commit that crime.
The cheating scandal that put him in federal prison and left the school in turmoil. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 10th of April, 2013. It's the birthday of the man who said, "Tourists don't know where they've been, travelers don't know where they're going." Paul Theroux, born in Medford, Massachusetts, 1941. After college, went in the Peace Corps, taught school in Malawi, and he wrote. And 10 years after college graduation, he had written 10 books, and it was the 10th that made his reputation, a book called The Great Railway Bazaar, a travelogue of his 4-month trip across Asia. His advice for aspiring writers, leave home. Because if you stay home, people will ask you questions that you can't answer. They say, what are you going to write? Where will you publish it? Who's going to pay you? How will you make a living? If you leave home, no one asks you questions like that. His advice for aspiring travel writers is the same. Leave home, but without a companion and never by plane. Theroux prefers trains. He said, ever since childhood, I have seldom heard a train go by and not wished I was on it. It's the birthday of Anne Lamott, born San Francisco, 1954. She was an alcoholic, an addict, who went into rehab, became a Christian, started teaching writing, published a journal of the first year of her son's life called Operating Instructions, came out in 1993 to great acclaim. Anne Lamott, who says, "Nothing can break the mood of a piece of writing like bad dialogue. My students are miserable when they are reading an otherwise terrific story to the class and then hit a patch of dialogue that is so purple and expositional that it reads like something from a childhood play by the Gabor sisters. I can see the surprise on my students' faces because the dialogue looked okay on paper, yet now it sounds as if it were poorly translated from their native Hindi." And it's the birthday of William Hazlitt, born in Maidstone, England, 1778. When he was 19, he walked 10 miles to hear Samuel Coleridge, and then he walked 200 miles to visit Coleridge at home. He became a journalist and essayist for newspapers. He wrote about art and sports, including boxing, drama, politics. He reviewed books, and then he took up lecturing, which was lucrative. He was an innovator in the development of the personal essay, the essay written in the first person, more discursive, free to wander away from the main theme. William Hazlitt, who said, "Without the aid of prejudice and custom, I should not be able to find my way across the room." Hazlitt said, "The most silent people are generally those who think most highly of themselves." Here's a poem for today by Jane Kenyon, "Philosophy in Warm Weather." Now all the doors and windows are open, and we move so easily through the rooms. Cats roll on the sunny rugs, and a clumsy wasp climbs the pane, pausing to rub a leg over her head. All around, physical life reconvenes. The molecules of our bodies must love to exist. They whirl in circles.
The National Weather Service has issued severe thunderstorm watch number 88, effective until 8 p.m. This watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Coles, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, and Vermilion. Remember, a severe thunderstorm watch means that conditions are favorable for the development of severe weather, including large hail and damaging winds in and close to the watch area. While severe weather may not be imminent, persons should remain alert for rapidly changing